You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
First say something that anyone here who actually knows me well won't believe at all, which is that I'm going to try not to speak very much during this because, as you can probably tell, I'm getting over bronchitis. Fortunately, I am here with my research better half, Hal Roberts, and he's going to be leading the show today.
So I think Ethan and I are supposed to introduce ourselves,
each other. Yeah.
First, I'll also point out that Jill and Rob have worked on this research with us, so... you can ask all of them the hard questions. So in addition to John Palfrey, who bravely led this research, and Ryan McGrady, who's no longer at the Berkman Center, who did a lot of the media research work, I did this work with Ethan. I'm not really sure how to introduce Ethan at the Berkman Center. He's well and widely known. Yes, among many other things, Ethan is the world's expert in independent and new media online, in especially activist media. He's started a website called Global Voices Online, which is a huge aggregator of international blogs. And he also wrote, when did you write your guide to blogging anonymously?
Probably
2005, that is still one of the handful of most referenced guides for security for dissident bloggers online.
And Hal Roberts, many people don't know, has been at the Berkman Center possibly longer than anybody else in this room. And generally speaking, is often the technical brains behind some of our hardest and most experimental-based research, has done work that's ranged from flying to Vietnam to test various different circumvention tools from within cyber cafes, to trying to analyze how much information all of us are leaking to Google via ad planning systems, interested in these questions of surveillance and invisible technologies of control, and has been doing this work for many, many years, and is a joy to collaborate with on papers like this one. This is a piece of research that we did in cooperation with support from friends at Open Society Institute. And it's probably worth mentioning that because we did a very specifically targeted piece of research within this general sphere of denial of service attacks. We were very much looking at the sort of independent media sites that I in general study, but that a group like OSI supports. So just to give a sense for what the constraint was on this paper, it was both a topic that we were very interested in, but it also was a topic that was sort of near and dear to the group that was providing support for the work. But I'll hand it over to Hal to walk through what we were able to find.
Okay. So first, this is, as are all good Berkman topics, this one is very complicated in politics and media and technology and other areas. Which is why we wrote, an 80-page paper about it. And I'm going to try really, really hard to only talk for about 20 minutes so that we have most of the time for questions. That means I'm going to gloss over a lot. So feel free to either interrupt me when I gloss over something you don't understand or to ask questions later. And I'll be as loud as I can. Gosh, your scratchy throat is catching. So this talk is about distributed denial of service attacks, specifically against human rights sites. What is a denial of service attack? A denial of service attack is some sort of attack that consumes the resources of the target machine to make that machine no longer be able to respond. So denial of service attacks have been around more or less as long as the internet. One of the earliest examples of a denial of service is called a TCP SYN attack, which is a way of overloading the specific way that TCP, which is one of the fundamental internet protocols, is implemented on most machines, such that you use up all of the available TCP connections with relatively few connecting, relatively few attacking computers. This is, you see, this is a CERT advisory from 1996. So this just goes to show that this has been a problem that's been happening for a long time. we're specifically interested in a subset of denial of service attacks called distributed denial of service attacks. The difference between the two is distributed denial of service attacks use lots of machines to attack you. And the big innovation that's happened for the attacker in this field is the rise of botnets. Botnets are armies of hacked computers that are centrally controlled in real time by via some channel. The first botnets were controlled via IRC channels. Now they've really diversified. One example of a command channel is on Twitter. So you can just find random channels like this on Twitter that just have streams of commands that are going out to the bots, where the bots are infected machines that are just logging onto Twitter once a minute and looking for commands. These are obviously encoded, but these commands say something like, give me all your credit card numbers, send out a bunch of spam, all 1,000 computers or all 1 million computers connect to CNN.com right now and download the page as fast as you can until it crashes. I wouldn't say initially, but one of the earliest, biggest uses of these DDoS attacks was against especially gambling sites. So to run a gambling, part of running an online gambling site now is having at least a system for DDoS defense, and probably in practice a system for DDoS offense as well. So a lot of the growth in DDoS has actually been fueled by gambling sites that live in obviously this sort of gray world and find themselves not wanting to go to authorities for help, even if they could help, and willing to attack their competitors as well.
And Hal mentions offense there, and it's certainly common for gambling sites to rent bots, attack each other. Increasingly, we're starting to see incredible collateral damage from this. I was on the phone last night to one of the lead researchers at Arbor Networks, which is probably the largest commercial, or certainly the best purveyor of commercial research in this space. They tracked what may be the largest internet outage of all time, which was a 9-hour outage affecting most of China, to a DDoS war between two online gaming providers, which ended at knocking out the DNS services of each other's ISPs and functionally knocked 95% of Chinese internet users off the net in what was basically a turf war between two companies.
And just to give a little bit...
Both in China and last year, which is why this largely in China has not been discussed.
To give a little bit of the idea of the scale here, these botnets, which are we'll talk about later, botnets aren't the only kind of DDoS attacks, but are one of the most common. The botnets can range anywhere from a few hundred computers to literally millions of computers in existence. So the attacks from these botnets can be anywhere from modest in scale to basically internet scale. So in addition to these commercial attacks, there's been a growth, especially in the last 5 to 10 years, of political use of DDoS attacks and botnets. This refers to this GhostNet research done by our friends at the University of Toronto. It was actually not an example of a botnet used for a DDoS. It was a botnet used to spy. It was a botnet that was installed on a bunch of computers, mostly in Asia, in politically sensitive organizations close to China, that was capable of spying on the organizations, basically. But the same sorts of things are done with DDoS, especially in very well-publicized cases in Russia and Georgia, Russia and Estonia, Israel and Palestine, and dozens of other global crises worldwide. The scale of these attacks are this is, again, data from Arbor, Arbor have DDoS monitoring slash protection machines in the overwhelming majority of major ISPs in the world, so they have a global view of what's going on with these attacks. They estimate, you see this is from a couple of days ago, they estimated they saw 700 attacks happening at any given time. Their daily numbers go anywhere from 5 to 1,500 attacks. For reasons that we'll describe a little bit later, we actually think this is a pretty strong underestimate of the kind of the number of attacks that are happening at any time, because a lot of the attacks are pretty small in scale for them to detect.
Right. Arbor basically sees the big ones, and in seeing the big ones, this was a slow news day for them. A thousand's about the average, and that's a thousand of the ones that are big enough for them to see, and it's possibly lots more going on.
So broadly, there are two kinds of these attacks. There are application attacks. So a TCP SYN attack is an example. Another very good example of an application attack is something called a slow loris attack. A slow loris attack is an attack that connects to your web server and then very slowly sends the request, right? So most web servers, all web servers have some limited number of connections they can serve at a time. It might be 50 or 300 or 5,000. And the idea is the faster you can, if you can process each request in a second and you've got 5,000 servers available, 5,000 processes, then you can process 5,000 requests per second. But if you have, say, just 10 machines, each of which are sitting on those connections and taking a minute to make the request, then all of a sudden, instead of 5,000 requests a second, you're down to 5,000 requests a minute. So it's very easy to overwhelm the machine using a relatively small number of attacking computers.
And basically, the more clever you get in an application attack, the more bang you get for your buck. So just sitting there and hitting reload on the homepage of a website isn't particularly clever. That page is probably cached. It probably gets delivered very, very quickly. Putting random terms into a search engine automatically might be fairly clever, because then it's issuing a database call for the separate term each time, puts a much heavier load on the machine. We know of one case where a major dissident media site, a site that is generally responsible for serving about 1 million page views a month, considered the core of a particular dissident community, was taken down by a script that basically hit its search engine 5 times a second. So, you know, fairly modest, very much within the scheme of what we would think is defensible, but highly targeted to the weakness of that system and managed to effectively take that site down.
So again, the point here is these attacks rely on cleverness to overwhelm the resources by making cleverness to make the machine overwhelm its own resources, basically, rather than just brute force. The bad news is they can be very clever and tough to figure out what's going on and defend about them. The good news is if you are clever enough, you can defend yourself. A good system administrator can get on the machine, figure out what's going on, build a defense, and do something about it. The other kind of attacks are network attacks. And in a network attack, all you do is you just flood the target computer with as much traffic as you can. And if you flood it with enough traffic, the traffic won't even get to the target machine. Instead, it will just clog the link between the machine and the rest of the internet. So the bad news here is, even if you're a really good system administrator and you've got your well-set-up machine hosted in some ISP, if you get attacked by a really big network attack, which is just this flood of packets, the majority of that attack isn't even going to get to your machine. It's just going to overwhelm your link to the internet, which is your ISP. And most likely, if you're sitting in an ISP, not only is your site going to be taken down, but all the sites hosted within that ISP are going to be taken down.
And something that's very, very useful to understand network attacks, it's usually not everyone associated with Anonymous going and saying, okay, let's all aim our targets at Citibank today. The really powerful network attacks are almost always what are called amplification attacks. What you basically do is you pretend to be the computer that's going to get attacked. You make a request for a very, very big document. Usually what you're requesting is a very complicated DNS record. You send out a request, and a large, large DNS server spits you back a huge volume of data. And what people have figured out how to do is how to put out a request that's, you know, basically 1K in size and get 70K back. And so you flood that DNS server, it comes back at 70 times the volume, but rather than hitting you, it hits your target. And that's where these really massive network attacks generally come from. Arbor this year is going to report the first 100 gigabit per second attack, and it's exactly that sort of amplification attack.
And those, again, are generally the biggest attacks are coming from botnets, and often some combination of botnets and amplification. It's really hard to find enough volunteers to compete with the number of compromised Windows boxes you can get access to relatively cheaply. So what do you do about these attacks? There's a sort of a scale of different defenses that you enact over time. The first thing you do is you just set up your machine better so you can serve more requests per second. If you're getting an attack that's 1,000 requests per second, if you can build a machine that can handle that, then you're good to go. The next thing you do is you build your machine to handle 10 times the number of requests it might have to handle legitimately. So if you the peak of your site is handling 100 requests a second, again, if you can add 10 more machines and handle 1,000 requests per second, and that's your attack size, then you'll be fine. The problem is that's obviously very expensive to maintain all that machinery for just the occasional attack. So the next approach is to use some sort of dynamic growth, usually in the cloud, so you can rent servers online, basically, and you can build systems that will automatically just add more resources as you get attacked to handle the attack size. The advantage of that is that you don't have to pay for that capacity to sit around all the time. You just pay for it when you need it. The disadvantage is you still have to pay for it. You can also filter the packets. So if you're clever enough to figure out what the attacking, some sort of signature that lets you differentiate between attacking and non-attacking traffic, and you can just block the traffic that you don't like. So if there are 500 computers attacking you, if you can figure out what the IP addresses of those 500 computers are, you can block them.
Just a quick question. Mm-hmm. These defenses, you're not ranking them with regards to two types of attacks you set out, network versus application.
We're going to explain on all of them that they're not particularly helpful to them. Okay. I mean, that's the problem, is that if any of these were worth sort of applying across the board, we would be cheering for them.
Okay. So the next, after filtering, you do something called scrubbing, which is just really a much more sophisticated version of filtering. There are big DDoS protection services, and in fact, most core internet organizations will let you buy a DDoS protection service. And what they basically do is they have a data center full of really fast routers that do the packet filtering for you. So all the packet here, instead of going directly to your machine, goes to potentially a whole data center container full of really fast routers that can do the packet filtering for you and filter out the bad traffic, ideally.
Are they also sharing new intelligence on what the bad traffic is?
Generally speaking, no. Generally, those are the crown jewels, and they're holding it to themselves.
Okay. And also, it's at a high level, it's a vastly complex job done in real time by really experienced people. So you probably wouldn't understand if they told you anyway. At that level, there are a few dozen people in the world who are doing that at most. Really, just a dozen who are doing it at scale.
This purpose here is to understand.
Understand at a high level.
I just offer that to you. That's why I'm here.
Yes, to understand this at a perfect level, and this is what we'll talk about later, there are probably a couple hundred people in the world who understand this at a perfect level, and they've all been doing this for 5 years as their full-time job. They're all really deep network, and it's not something that even I'm a pretty smart, pretty technical guy. I don't understand the deep specifics of this. I understand basically what's going on, but part of what we'll talk about later is there's a really deep specific technical expertise that's needed to defend against this.
What's going on conceptually is someone is looking at a flood of traffic. They're trying to find signatures that define what traffic is legitimate and what traffic is illegitimate. It's what's happening within an individual system. What an individual system then tries to do, this is what Dan was trying to do when the Berkman Center got attacked, was trying to figure out what's legitimate and what's illegitimate. In scrubbing, you're basically saying, this is too big for one sysadmin to figure out how to do it here. We're going to outsource it to a set of professional sysadmins who deal with this constantly. They're going to look for signatures they've seen in the past. They're going to apply it to the traffic. They're going to try to pass through the good traffic and block the bad traffic. So this is something that you would do if you had a great deal of money. It's not available to most people under attack because it tends to cost $40,000 or $50,000 a month to have this on call. Answering Tolo's earlier question, this is sort of in some ways basically the cheap to expensive version here, not necessarily effectiveness. These last two basically are techniques that get used against network flood attacks. When you are flooded by packets, it doesn't help you to filter anymore because no one else can get into you. You're simply getting all those packets blocking you. You either have to work on source mitigation,
which means you have to talk to someone who's routing traffic to you and say, please stop this traffic, it's killing me. So you got to hold it back for the moment.
So what that means is if I'm Google and I'm being attacked, I will actually, and I see that there are a couple of big network blocks in Comcast residential ISPs that are the source of attacks, I will literally get on the phone with Comcast and say, these two networks are attacking me, please don't send any more traffic from them. And that way the traffic just gets blocked right at the source rather than filling up your link.
What happens if you go even further than this is you end up saying, I'm going to tell Comcast that I don't exist anymore. Or I'm going to tell Comcast not to route the packets to me anymore, I'm going to tell them to route them somewhere else. And that's called dynamic rerouting. There's problems with every one of these things. We know that server optimization helps quite a bit with application attacks, not across the board. Overcapacity is a real problem. You're basically buying 10 times as much server as you need. The dynamic capacity growth is a pretty good strategy, but you can't just automatically turn it on. You need a relationship ahead of time so that you can get your stuff over to Amazon so you can change your routing tables.
And you still, you know, if you build a dynamic, you know, capacity growth system that lets you handle, you know, 10 megabits per second of traffic or a gigabit per second of traffic, you have to pay for that. It's expensive. Someone has to pay for the bandwidth at some point.
The reason we've been ducking questions on packet filtering, rate limiting, and scrubbing is that it's basically a dark art practiced by a couple hundred people. And, you know, we know the very basics of it, but we're sort of at level one. And the guys who actually do it effectively are at level 8 or level 9, and that's why people often outsource it. But they pay quite a bit of money for it. It's routine to pay anywhere from $30,000 to $100,000 for someone who's running a scrubbing farm on top of your tribe. That's per month, not per year. And it can go much higher if you're regularly under attack. Source mitigation, being able to call Comcast and say, shut off your traffic, that really only happens between sysadmins who know each other really, really well through a closed group of network operator mailing lists. And dynamic rerouting, which can be very, very effective, requires that you have your own autonomous system, which is to say you actually edit the routing tables for how traffic gets to you. That's very rare. I mean, Harvard is not an autonomous system. Harvard is under someone else's ASIN.
Harvard is an autonomous system, but the number of... It requires both an autonomous system and a really deep level of network voodoo.
Right, but we're not rerouting here.
Yes, deep network voodoo, yes.
So how, the only problem, I mean, dynamic rerouting seems like you're just sending the traffic to somebody else.
No, you just say, we don't exist anymore. You just send an ASM.
You just null route it to them.
You null route it. You say this.
So the router at the beginning just returns an error.
The rerouting just refers to changing the route. So you just publish, it's a BGP announcement. You just say, you send it to a specific net. So instead of sending it to the world. So we should say there's another solution here that we don't include, which is just universal null routing, which is the most common response of ISPs to network attacks, which is just to say if you're that one machine on ISP that's being attacked and it's knocked out the whole ISP, the ISP can say to the world, that target machine does not exist anymore. Stop sending me the traffic. And that works. It's a very effective defense. Except the site that was being attacked goes down. Mm-hmm.
And as
the rest
you'll
of the
see, it
back.
Happens almost half the time in attacks. Yes.
Just a quick question. I keep thinking about airlines. And how does an airline, for instance, or let's say someone who's the military, who's targeting with a drone, you know, there's a diverse portfolio now of denial of service.
There's a very big difference between internet exposed services and closed networks. Right. So, you know, my sincere hope is that the U.S. military is not targeting drones using the World Wide Web. My sincere hope is that
can get inside of a...
That's a pretty serious oversimplification. Generally speaking, closed networks, the sort of network that you would use for an air traffic system, which you would use for military targeting, there's what's referred to as an air gap between those systems and these sort of public network systems. These public network systems are not meant to be 100% reliable. We treat them as 100% reliable because they usually are 100% reliable, and now we've grown used to them being 100% reliable. DDoS is basically a profound reminder that they are not 100% reliable. If you have something that you absolutely need to be mission critical, like a missile that's being targeted, you would want to keep an air gap between that and the public internet. There are legitimate concerns that that air gap doesn't exist as much as people think. This was sort of the whole brouhaha around Stuxnet, was basically people saying that systems that you would expect to be wholly insulated from that sort of attack turned out to have some vulnerabilities. But conventional DDoS is not going after air traffic systems. It's going after the airline's website so that you can make reservations for it, rather than going after those core systems.
Okay, so all this is just background. So why did we do this? What did we do? So all of this, what we've given you is basically background, and it's just us reporting more interesting work by other people. Our specific questions, we know that DDoS is a really big deal on the internet. We know, for instance, Arbor has a survey that it does every year of internet service providers, and for the past few years, it's been the most the biggest. It's the biggest source of security expenses for major internet organizations is defending themselves against DDoS attacks. So it's a really big deal for the core of the internet to deal with this stuff. But what we didn't know is that what specific impact this was having on independent media and dissident media and human rights type sites. We have lots of anecdotes. Our funder had new specific of its own fundees who were suffering these attacks. And we wanted to get a better sense of, are these attacks common? What types of attacks are happening against independent media sites specifically? What impacts are they having? Are these sites able to defend themselves or are they not? And specifically, our funder wanted to us even to help think about what kinds of responses would be most helpful within the specific community. So what did we do? We did four different kinds of big research to try to figure out what was going on here. We did a media research, which is just looking up all the reports in the media of these attacks against political or human rights type sites. We did a survey of independent media sites to ask them what their experiences were. We did more in-depth technical interviews with some of those respondents to our surveys and other people we came in contact with to find out deep information about what kinds of attacks they had suffered and how they had defended themselves. And we also hosted a meeting here at Harvard of a combination of independent media publishers and really smart technologists and academics and foundations funding this kind of work to try to get everybody in the same room together thinking about this stuff. What we learned that the attacks are common, which I'll discuss how we know that in a minute. That's a very vague term, purposefully. We don't have any sort of number like 10% of or 90% of independent media sites get attacked, but we know that they're common, they happen often. We know that independent media are particularly vulnerable to these attacks because they exist at the edge of the internet, and we'll talk a little bit about what that means as we go on. Another result that we found out is that you can't consider these DDoS attacks in isolation. Independent media suffer from all kinds of different online attacks, and they often happen in combination with DDoS attacks and in synergistic ways. So you have to think about the larger problem of technical and political attacks against these sites. We learned that application attacks have some solutions, not necessarily great, but you can think of ways to certainly mitigate those kinds of attacks and keep it the network attacks are much harder. They require some combination of really deep expertise and someone paying for bandwidth, and both of those are expensive, and there's no really easy solution for how to solve those problems for independent media especially. So in our media research, we found 140, in the past year, we found 140 reports of attacks against 280 separate sites. This is a partial list of affected sites.
And this is just human rights sites. So there's far more DDoS going on than this. These are sort of sites that were within the neighborhood of our definition of it. So you see organizations like Yezi.org, which is one of the main Tunisian dissident organizations. There's a number of major Russian independent media, more or less the entirety of the Vietnamese independent human rights community. One thing that I would mention in all of this is, as we started doing media analysis on this, we were not able to say that there's a strong association between a political point of view and being a DDoS target. We've seen Republican politicians in the US be DDoSed. We've seen any number of sites that individuals considered to be anti-American and pro-terrorist be DDoSed. We've seen the Israelis DDoSing the Palestinians DDoSing the Israelis. We've seen conflicts that we didn't know about. We ended up spending a lot of time studying Malaysia and Indonesia, who have a long-standing conflict over who stole whose culture.
So the problem with all of this is it's incredibly difficult from this sampling method, which is basically running huge Boolean queries and saying, where do we see DDoS attacks that might be human rights, to say this was comprehensive. The first thing to understand about DDoS is that the vast majority goes unreported, in part because people often don't understand what's going on. You sort of go, oh, my web server is down. Then there's a lot of people who don't want to report it because they don't want to call attention to it. DDoS is often an attention gathering target. So we're able to offer a limited look at some of the conflicts that we know about where DDoS has come into play. If you want background on this, there's an amazing paper by Jose Nazario, which is basically a history of politically motivated DDoS up until 2008, which is sort of the authoritative work on the subject. What we were able to find is Jose outlines about a dozen cases. We were able to find, you know, more than 100 in a year, and probably 20 that would have been worth writing about, giving us a sense that this is actually quite an enormous problem.
So one of the paradoxes of DDoS attacks is even though this is clearly a huge problem at the core of the internet, so there are a huge amount of the resources that are going towards just keeping the internet basically running are going towards defending against these attacks. The paradox is that the defenses basically seem to be working pretty well, which is to say Google and CNN.com and New York Times and Facebook are not going down every other day because of a DDoS attack. They are being attacked, and they are defending themselves.
Let me pause for half a second. Hal and I end up using these terms core and edge a lot in how we understand the internet. There is a technical definition to them. At the core of the internet is a set of what are called tier one internet service providers. These guys carry the vast majority of the world's traffic. Everybody else is a customer of them. Those 12 or so companies, plus maybe 10 big companies like Google, Akamai, so on and so forth, control the vast majority of internet traffic. And almost everybody else is essentially clients to them. At that core level, and we can in the questions get into, you know, how you specifically define tier one, that core level, those sysadmins work incredibly closely together. They've all got each other on speed dial. They have tight, closed mailing lists where they coordinate with one another. They share a great deal of information. As you get farther out towards the peripheries, if you're using Joe's Bit Shack in Kampala, that person is out at what we sort of refer to as tier three. They are a customer of someone who is a customer of someone who is a customer of a tier one operator. At that level, they probably have very little recourse to talk to the sysadmins at the center of this. They are basically just a client. They are not treated with much more deference than you are as an ISP's client. Being at the edge in terms of DDoS is a really bad thing, because most of the solutions that work, as Hal was saying, work for the core. If you are one of those core operators and you're being attacked by people who are on two other core operators, you call those guys and you say, hey, cut it out. But if you are a client of that core operator, it's very, very hard for you to issue that phone call.
So this is a picture by a group called Keita, which is a big organization that collects data and analyzes data about the structure of the internet, basically, so how traffic is routed on the internet. These are all of the what are called autonomous systems, which are basically ISPs on the internet. So the internet is a network of networks. They are the networks. And you can see here, the point here is that there's a relatively small number of red and yellow ISPs that sit really at the core of the internet, that all of the other, if you're one of these guys on the edge, in order to get to some other guy on the edge, you have to send your traffic to one of those core guys and then send it back out. So the point is that the internet is very centralized and actually becoming much more so over the past few years. For those core ISPs, there's data that show that actually 75% of core network organizations respond to a typical DDoS attack in less than an hour, And I think about 50% respond in less than 15 minutes. So this is what we say when this is a sort of manageable problem for these guys. In addition to the expertise and or in addition to the sort of community connections that Ethan talks about, they also have other key requirements for dealing with these attacks. One is they just have a ton of bandwidth, so they can just absorb the bandwidth. The other is that they have economies of scale. They get attacked all the time, so they have staffs that deal with this, and they've seen all the kinds of attacks. So they know how to deal with them, and it's just a matter of recognizing what kind of attack it is and then deploying the correct tool to deal with it instead of having to constantly refigure things out.
So if you were Google or UUNet, DDoS is just an everyday aspect of business. You're probably attacked multiple times a week. You fend them off pretty quickly. You probably have an internal security team that has as many as 10 people on it. This is not a huge problem for you, although the cost of it ends up affecting all of your customers. Where this is a huge problem is if you're an independent human rights site. So one of the groups that we got a great deal of useful information from is Viet Tan. Viet Tan is a pro-democracy organization that sort of acts in many ways as a blanket organization for a lot of Vietnamese dissident organizations. These guys are under DDoS attack almost continually. They very much blame it on the Vietnamese government. It's very, very hard to verify that. But what we can verify is that they put up a new web service and it is often attacked within hours. And you will see large floods of traffic coming in and attempting to take down their servers. It's been effective enough that at this point, Viet Tan no longer really tries to run their own servers. They, when they launch new products, tend to launch them as blogger blogs. So for instance, they're doing a major anti-censorship campaign called nofirewall.net. They launched it on Blogger, put up their own domain name, and had it pointing to Blogger because they're simply not capable of dealing with the scale of DDoS that they're getting. One of the reasons that they are not capable of dealing with it is that they're not just getting conventional DDoS. Probably the most important finding of our paper is that people aren't just experiencing DDoS, they're experiencing a whole range of attacks. So of the people who responded to us and said, we've been attacked with a DDoS, 72% of those are also filtered by a national government. It's certainly true of Viet Tan. The Vietnamese government tries very, very hard to make sure that no one in Vietnam is able to access that site. 39% of those who have experienced this have seen some sort of an intrusion, and 32% have seen a defacement where someone comes in, takes down your homepage, and puts something else up. As far as just experiencing one of these, 81% of the people in our set who said we experienced a DDoS experienced at least one of these other things. So we've ended up saying you can't think about this in the human rights community in isolation. Just to give you an explanation of how complicated this can get, our friends at Viet Tan helped uncover a very strange and sort of fascinating story, which is that they were not just being attacked by any old botnet. They were being attacked by the Vietnamese users around the world they wanted to deliver content to. The reason for that is that if you want to write in Vietnamese, you need a particular piece of software called a keyboard driver. The keyboard driver maps your keyboard into the Vietnamese character set. The most popular keyboard driver out there is distributed by a group called the Vietnamese Professional Society, US-based Society of Vietnamese. It's basically a social club. Somebody, I wonder who, hacked into vps.org, replaced the keyboard driver with a Trojan horse which compromises your machine. That Trojan horse is capable of reading your keystrokes and reporting them to someone else. It's also capable of seizing your computer and harnessing it in a DDoS. So Viet Tan and associated sites had this incredible problem. They were being attacked with bogus traffic from precisely the people they wanted to reach, which is to say Vietnamese at home and in the diaspora. This makes filtering much, much, much harder. In general, if we're here at Berkman and we suddenly get flooded with packets from South Korea, we can say that might be a DDoS because we don't have any content in Korean. If we want to make a decision, we could say, okay, we're going to shut off Korea for the moment and we're not going to let Koreans get to us. Viet Tan didn't have that option, because the people who were attacking them were the people they were trying to reach. It's an incredibly sinister way of doing things, and we're starting to see attacks at this level of sophistication.
So coming back to the application versus network attacks, this is some data, again, from Arbor, about how common the different sorts of attacks are. And you can see here that this 45% of attacks are what they call flood-based, which we call network attacks. And they break down into protocol versus application, but all of that we just count as an application attack. So basically about half of the flood-based, they're saying about half of attacks are flood-based. But what we found is we sent them a list of 31 sites that according to our survey responses had been attacked in the past year, and asked them to give us all the details they had basically on the attacks against those sites with the dates that they happened. They were only able to find 7 of those attacks in their system. And we think that's because most of those attacks were either small network attacks or application attacks that were small in scale. And so this is a small bit of evidence that Arbor is actually pretty strongly under-reporting the number of attacks that are happening in the world and under-reporting the proportion of these application-type attacks versus the network-type attacks.
So one of the big problems with DDoS is that if you get DDoSed, there is a very good chance that your ISP will simply try to save themselves. And there's good reason for this. If it's a significant attack, it may be compromising the other sites hosted by the ISP. Many ISPs are using shared servers. If you're overwhelming your particular server, you're affecting everybody else who's sharing that same server. If you're clogging the pipe, if you're overwhelming the network, you are affecting everybody else that the company is holding. If you read your hosting agreement with an ISP, it will generally explicitly make it okay for them to null route you or otherwise terminate you in the case of a DDoS attack. We found a small number, a little bit more than a third of ISPs, would step up and defend their clients against DDoS, sometimes for an extra fee, sometimes essentially saying, if this happens to you often, we're going to have to bill you more. But we also found that the majority were simply shutting them down.
So this is really huge.
For how long?
Shut down during the duration of the attack, and often, as we'll tell you in this story, asked to gently move on after the fact.
So this is a really big problem. So you remember again that we said that, especially for these network attacks, you're completely dependent on your ISP to defend you. And this finding says that in the majority of cases, the ISP actually becomes part of the problem rather than part of the solution. They're not willing to act in that role, so they simply don't defend you and you are down. And the only thing that you can do is look for some other ISP who might defend you, but the evidence is there are not many of those and they are expensive.
So one of the incidents that actually sparked this research was an attack on Irrawaddy.org. Irrawaddy is the largest Burmese dissident media site. It was, at the time of this attack, about 2.5 years ago, hosted just across the border in Thailand. It was actually hosted in Bangkok, but there's a huge Burmese population that lives just across the Thai border, and that's where Burmese activism tends to be concentrated. Irrawaddy is a very popular site in the neighborhood of 250,000 users per month. They experienced a sustained DDoS attack of over 2 gigabits of traffic per second over the course of several days. This was effective not only in knocking Irrawaddy off the internet, but knocking Thailand off the internet. And so Thailand was briefly off the internet until the internet service provider did what internet service providers did and null routed.
So this is very common. Most countries have their own ISPs because it's having your ISP.
It's like having a national airline.
Right. Well, and it's more important than a national airline. It lets you set the policies of your own network, right? I mean, I argue, the point of the internet and the point of autonomous systems is you can set the politics of your network and interrupt with the other networks. But they're small countries, so they're either what we call a tier 2 ISP, which is sort of, you know, a medium-sized ISP, or a lot of these countries are really even tier 3 ISPs. They're very small ISPs. For those ISPs, an attack of 1 gigabit per second will take them down. So a 1 gigabit per second attack will take down pretty much any tier 3 ISP and some tier 2 ISPs. A 10 gigabit per second attack will take down all but, you know, a few dozen ISPs in the world, all but the biggest tier 2 ISPs and the tier 1 ISPs. The tier 1 attacks are pretty common, or the 1 gigabit attacks are pretty common, and the 10 gigabit attacks are not uncommon.
And by the way, Irrawaddy has moved on. They were asked by their ISP to go elsewhere. They did go elsewhere. This year they were attacked. They're always attacked on 8/8.
It's a very important date in Burmese history, referring back to 8888. Look it up in Wikipedia. This year's attack was more than 4 gigs per second. They were on a DDoS-resistant ISP. This ISP might have been able to handle the attack, but they hadn't paid for that level of coverage. So that ISP simply shut them down because they paid for 2 gigabits per second guaranteed service, but not 4 gigabits guaranteed service. And the ISP basically said, come up with several thousand dollars, otherwise we shut you off, and they decided to go down instead.
So all of this is pointing again toward the importance of being in the in one of those core organizations. So the core includes, as Ethan said, these sort of big tier one ISPs. It includes something called content distribution networks, which are big companies like Akamai that cache content all around the web so that if you're going to CNN.com from China, you get CNN.com from a local server rather than going all the way to Atlanta. Akamai claims that it transits about 20% of the traffic of the internet, so they're really core players. And then increasingly there are these handful of our friends at Arbor called hypergiant content hosts, so companies like Google and Facebook that host some significant portion of the overall traffic of the internet. This is a very interesting post, again, by someone at Arbor that shows that the red line is for 2007, and that's the number of autonomous systems that handle 50% of the content of the internet, and the blue line is for 2009. So you can see what's happening here is really in 2007, there used to be sort of thousands of ISPs that were handling the sort of bulk of the traffic of the internet, and now there are hundreds instead. And that what that means is that the internet is getting bigger in the middle. That means that middle is better able to handle these kinds of scaled attacks, but it also means the edges are less able to handle these kinds of attacks.
How are you defining content in this context, and how much of this change is just saying streaming video has gotten really big, a few people are doing massive bandwidth because of streaming video, and everyone else is pretty much the same as they were 2 years ago?
I think that's got to be at least part of it. I'm sure they're doing at least in part a bandwidth-based measure rather than just a transaction-based measure. But I would also argue that the long tail is getting less and less significant in terms of delivery of bandwidth. And certainly we are seeing consolidation in business terms as well as consolidation in network terms. So I agree with you. I think that the YouTube effect is part of it. But at the same time as the YouTube effect, there's the Akamai effect, which is to say lots and lots of people are deciding not to serve their content. There's the Blogger effect. People are deciding I'm not going to host my own service anymore. I'm going to host it via Blogger. There's the Gmail effect. I don't run my own SMTP anymore. I run it off of Gmail. You can also, you know, use the same slide and put on top of it the rise of the cloud, and that's certainly one way to look at it. What it means in general, though, is that there are certain benefits and certain costs to being in the core, and there are certain benefits and certain costs of being at the periphery, and that's actually becoming a broader gap over time, or at least that's what we believe based on sort of our analysis of the human rights sites in this context.
And I don't think it's really even helpful to break out the video because, video is what's driving certainly a major driver of big consumer broadband pipes, right? And those big consumer broadband pipes are part of what's driving the size of these DDoS attacks, right? So even if it's all video, if you're just whatever is happening to increase the size of those pipes, both in the middle and the edges, when you redirect all that massive traffic towards some other edge, it's bad news.
Video is also what's driving the human rights sites to the core, which is to say, if I am Nawat.org and I suddenly get into the business of distributing lots and lots and lots of Tunisian street protest videos, keeping my site up gets harder and harder and harder because suddenly my bandwidth bills are increasing, my server load is increasing, and it becomes more attractive to do it from a core.
So as we said before, one of the interesting parts about this is lots of consumers don't see it. Because everything just kind of works. You don't necessarily, it happens as Blogger doesn't go down, or at least it does not go down often at all. And in effect, what's happening is a sort of system of social insurance like we have with credit cards. So there's whatever 2% of every credit card bill you pay goes toward replacing the cost of credit card fraud and theft, right? And we don't sort of notice it, and it's worth the convenience of using credit cards, but it just gets absorbed, for the most part, absorbed into the system so that nobody, no single person has to bear the cost. Essentially, we think this is happening with the internet. So the internet is costing a little bit more to run. You know, Google charges its advertisers a little bit more, so everything in our world costs a little bit more in order to protect us all from these DDoS attacks. But as long as you're in that core that's getting these increased costs, you're fine. The problem is with credit cards is that people in the periphery get screwed. So in the case of credit cards, the people who really get hit are small vendors, right? They get hit with chargebacks. So they're bearing the risk basically of credit card fraud. If you're some small business, then you get a chargeback request. There's nothing to do. You just have to pay it and you just bear the loss. And it's the same thing for, in this case, small internet sites. They're not protected. They're not in this core of organizations, so they don't have the bandwidth, they don't have the expertise, they don't have the connections, and it becomes very difficult. They bear catastrophic risk of having to deal with these attacks.
This insurance metaphor is also helpful to us in sort of thinking through one of the problems that we were asked to sort of think about for this funder, which was, should you build dedicated human rights hosting to be DDoS resistant? And on the surface, it sounds like a great idea, right? This is a huge problem. It's really affecting these guys. Let's put them together. We'll learn from each other's experience. One of the big problems with this is that you've suddenly put all your riskiest customers in one pool. And from the insurance perspective, that's a really dangerous thing to do. We know that the sorts of human rights and independent media sites that we are looking at are probably more likely than a random internet site to get targeted for a DDoS attack. And so if you're putting all of these guys together, you're essentially saying, let's have a special class of insurance for, you know, our most dangerous drivers, or for everyone who, you know, sells kerosene by the bucketful. It's very, very hard to know what that price is, in part because one thing that was very difficult in this research is just figuring out general prevalence. Again, people underreport, they don't know when they've been attacked. It's very, very hard to figure it out. Literally, if you were going to start a dedicated human rights hosting provider, one of the first questions would be, do you charge $100 a month, $1,000 a month, $10,000 a month? And you have to think about what the market will actually bear. We know of one essentially dedicated human rights hosting provider out there. They're able to solve the problem by charging $0 a month. And they're able to do that because they're a research provider who basically provides service gratis in exchange for the guarantee that you will be DDoSed. So they only want you if you are very likely to be DDoSed because they want to study you. And so they'll happily host you as long as you are highly likely to be DDoSed. The question is, how scalable is that business model? I suspect they can probably pull it off for the first couple of dozen. It may get a little difficult once it's up to 1,000 or so.
And we also know, I mean, there are a couple of other human rights-oriented DDoS protection services that are working pretty well, but are terrified of anybody knowing who they are, who they're hosting. And so they're very heavily at this point relying on this sort of security through obscurity for this exact reason, because if the right people figured out that a significant portion of the world's important sites are at this particular small organization that's trying to protect them, then they could obviously all go down. Amr keeps raising his hand.
I just wanted to quickly pipe in from the IRC, just on probably the slide right before that, about a question of, so this is stable communications depend on economies of scale, but couldn't it also be don't depend on broadcast, be small world networks as well?
So we're going to actually jump right into that. So that's a great way of sort of getting into that. Maybe the most controversial suggestion we make in the paper is urging small independent media sites to think about moving to cloud hosting. And the reason we end up saying this is that it is significantly easier for a small human rights organization that doesn't have a lot of technical talent to defend against an attack by saying, hey, Google, defend me against this attack, rather than trying to defend themselves.
So to make clear, Blogger in particular offers a world-class DDoS protection service for no financial cost. So if you host your website on the beauty of squirrels on Blogger, and it gets massively, you know, DDoSed by a 50 gigabit attack from the, you know, squirrel jihad of the world, then Blogger will protect you. They think there's a fundamental, you know, service they're providing there. But there are lots of sort of functional and PR reasons why people don't want to be seen on Blogger. But the bigger cost is that if to the degree we encourage the independent media of the world to move into the umbrella of Google, then we're exchanging the control of those people who are DDoSing them for the control of Google, who can choose to shut them down, if not for attack reasons, then for other reasons. And there's unfortunately history of sites, of big companies shutting down sites on request for in not good ways.
The new canonical story on this, which broke literally as we were releasing the paper, which was a little complicated because we had to sort of rethink whether we wanted to stand by our conclusion, was when WikiLeaks attempted to move on to Amazon. And so WikiLeaks was coming under sustained DDoS on its European hosting architecture. They had really legitimate concerns about whether they were going to be able to keep the site up. They made a decision to do one of the recommendations that we saw, which was move to a scalable architecture. Amazon offers a fairly low-cost, scalable architecture. Amazon, unfortunately, also proved itself extremely willing to cave under political pressure from Joe Lieberman's office, who called them up and said, you shouldn't be hosting this stuff. Amazon very quickly decided that the content was in violation of terms of service, decided not to provide service. It's not hard to take a lesson from this that you shouldn't trust Amazon, don't host your content with them. That's actually the wrong lesson. The lesson that you should be taking is anytime you're hosting content with anybody, anyone, including yourself taking service from an internet service provider, you are potentially victim to what's called intermediary censorship. That intermediary has a terms of service or a code of conduct that they can use to assert control over your content. You could do what Jillian does with her site and host with Bluehost, a truly reprehensible American hosting company that has a terrible, terrible history of pulling down content for completely arbitrary reasons. And they could pull you down simply because they don't like where you're hosted or what you're doing with it. This is not an Amazon-specific problem. It is not a WikiLeaks-specific problem. It is an internet architecture problem. And we either need to respond to this thinking about it architecturally, as Wendy just suggested, which is finding ways to serve web content off of peer networks, which is theoretically possible and practically very difficult at this stage of the game. Or we need to build some sort of consumer movement to demand that when companies engage in intermediary censorship, that there are market consequences for them. At the same time of all of this, we watched Anonymous bring DDoS to the general attention of the public by getting people together to load a fairly simple piece of software called the Low Orbit Ion Canet, pointed at the targets that Amazon felt had wronged WikiLeaks. One of the things that we thought was very interesting about this was Anonymous actually helped demonstrate the limits of that style of DDoS. Anonymous was mostly able to take down marketing sites. They were able to take down sort of the PR and marketing sites for MasterCard and PayPal, but that isn't where people are going. People aren't going to PayPal to the PayPal blog, which is what they took down. They were going to PayPal's payment system, which they were not able to materially affect. They went after the API, had a limited effect on it. They briefly went after Amazon and very quickly threw up their hands and said, we can't do a damn thing to this. What's really interesting is that these sort of let's get the gang together and go knock down David Weinberger's site because we hate his coverage of our talk, they work against Weinberger-sized targets.
They work against even like Berkman Center-sized targets. So they work against medium sites or even big sites like MasterCard.com that the company hasn't bothered to protect. But the sites that are actively being protected by strong services in the core, they generally don't work against. They're just not big enough.
So look, what we ended up recommending very briefly to these sites is that they need to have a plan ahead of time. If you haven't been attacked yet, it's probably because you haven't pissed off the right people. You are very likely to be attacked if you are an independent media site in certain environments. You need to figure out how to minimize the amount of custom-generated dynamic content you're serving, because it's the most expensive thing your server does. You need to figure out how to robustly monitor your site, because what often happens is people find 24 hours later that they've been being DDoSed, they had no idea that they were under attack. You need really good mirrors that are already in place, and ideally you want to automatically fail over onto them. Some of those mirrors probably need to be in the cloud, hosting on something like Blogger,
And you need to find ways to use hosting providers who will A, defend your rights, B, keep you in the loop, and C, not immediately cut you loose. And generally speaking, independent media is always strapped for cash. They're always on the 10 bucks a month, you know, Joe's Bit Shack. Joe's Bit Shack does not care about you. As soon as you make a call to Joe's Bit Shack for service, you have eaten up the annual profit that they are making off of you. They have no incentive to provide you customer service. As soon as you make that one customer service phone call, as soon as they spend 5 minutes of sysadmin time, you have eaten their margin for the whole year. So you're probably going to end up paying for this. You're probably going to end up paying at a much higher rate than you would for the low-end type of services. In general, what we're finding is that to fight this off, we need to change the ecosystem of how we support these sites. This isn't just about DDoS, it's about all forms of attack. And what we're finding is actually effective is that within some communities, and by communities I sort of mean, you know, the dissidents for a particular country, you will see a group or a person emerge who becomes the technical contact for that community. So we had the opportunity to study one community where a particular individual has emerged as the technical contact. 10 different organizations have turned over the reins of their servers to this one guy. And this guy, who knows that human rights community very well, but also knows the geek community very well, is able to get on the phone to these highly wired, highly connected core services, and is often able to fend off some of these DDoS attacks. We would love to see the ecosystem change so that different human rights and independent media communities had a tech leader, and that those tech leaders were tightly networked to one another and tightly networked to a group of core companies who want to help. Companies like Google, like Yahoo, actually really do want to help on this. The problem is they're in a really bad spot when they get the phone call at 3 a.m. from Viet Thanh saying, our website is down, would you please help us? And we've watched people like the human rights coordinator of Yahoo occasionally stride in and actually save the day. It's not a sustainable model. The sustainable model is going to have to do with Viet Thanh talking to someone who knows the Vietnamese human rights community well, talking to the lead geek there, having that lead geek then escalate through the chain. But we're going to need to figure out a way to build that. In the meantime, we're going to end up more and more reliant on this cloud hosting. And as we're more and more reliant on other people's hosting, we have to take the intermediary censorship issue seriously, which probably means building a policy response and a public pressure response to make sure that you see what Amazon did to WikiLeaks happens less often. And now, having taken three times the time that we thought we would.
Is the paper downloadable?
It is, yeah. From our site.
Just thank you very much. This was brilliant. But I just had a question about your recommendations. What about competitive pressure from the side of the ISPs? Because you really talked about the intermediary and how the intermediary can be a problem. But wouldn't it be a competitive advantage for one particular intermediary to say, here's my terms of service, and I'm not going to do A, B, C, D? And would it be possible to apply pressure? I'm not sure how, either through a public movement to cause someone who's pretty big to say, this is what we want to do, this is a new contract, social contract we want to come into with internet users, and cause change in that from that point of view.
I think you're thinking in exactly the right direction. When we talk about a public pressure response, what we're basically talking about is the need for an organization that tracks good behavior and bad behavior, and over time helps customers differentiate between the two. What we've been doing so far is just sort of naming and shaming. The reason I decided to pick on Bluehost is that they're deserving of a certain amount of shame. They have done terrible work in this space. Unfortunately, they remain the number two hosting provider in the United States. And so, you know, my attempts to shame them have not gone particularly far. So we probably need an organization that's doing this on a much more regular basis and helping people make those decisions, as well as a way for people to make decisions. Where that approach starts to fail is when the people you want to shame are, let's say, a very large social network with, say, 500 million users. It's very, very hard to convince people to leave a company like that, even if the company has a poor track record of defending human rights online, because there aren't really any good alternatives. you may be friends with lots of other people on said network, and you might not want to lose those friendships. So the switching cost there is much higher than the switching cost of switching from a web hosting provider.
And I think there's also actually a sort of structural problem there, which is that for a large social media site, they are catering toward the vast majority of their users. And by definition, independent media folks are not the vast majority of users. And to the degree that the internet is centralizing activity on these relatively smaller number of sites, they are necessarily going to cater their behavior towards the large bulk of their users. Facebook's problem is that this is generally a hard problem. So what Facebook sees or what YouTube sees is they get an email in Arabic saying, you need to take this video, there's a video of a guy being beaten to a pulp. You need to take that's gratuitously violent. You need to take it down, and then they have to decide: is this a meaningful video? Is that a policeman beating that guy? Is this something that the world is a better place for this being available, or is it just gratuitous violence? That's a really, really hard decision to make, and it's really expensive to make it. And the easy thing to do, if you have lots of users to please, is just to say, look, we don't want violent videos on our site, right? So, I think ultimately the answer has to be some degree. What these companies have done very poorly is they've had very little transparency. The knee-jerk response is to say, this is not political, we're not in this realm, we're just making our decisions based on these terms of service, so we don't want to be in this discussion, because it's just a really hard discussion. They need to recognize that they are in that position. They need to accept that they're in this heavy political position and have some sort of transparency in the way that they make decisions.
And while Facebook has been slower to act than either Google or Yahoo, Tunisia may turn out to be a turning point for them. First of all, with Tunisia, Facebook itself essentially came under attack. People were phishing for Facebook passwords, and that caught Facebook's attention. Facebook also was very, very heavily used by Tunisians who, you know, did suffer this problem of essentially saying, is this appropriate content or not? But I think it may have activated them in a way that it hadn't previously. This is an issue that Jillian follows very, very closely and who we sort of rely on for keeping us up to date on this. But as we think about this general policy framework, and by the way, you just articulated more or less a mission statement for it, we need to think about not just the hosting providers who really are in a commodity business, but, you know, YouTube isn't really a commodity anymore. It's very hard to get people off of YouTube onto Dailymotion or Vimeo, and it's really, really hard to get people off of Facebook onto a competitor.
So people in Congress have talked about public hosting for human rights groups. That would have the danger of your censorship coming from, obviously, whoever was running that, U.S. government or whatever. On the other hand, it would allow some human rights organizations a backup, which they can't otherwise afford. What's the view
on
that?
I would have three worries with a proposal like that. The first one is that it's hard to imagine the intermediary censorship being less aggressive than the censorship from, say, a Google. The second is that you've created a honeypot. So the U.S. government has just declared, you've declared a rich target. The U.S. government has declared we're going to host these sites because they're sufficiently important, and we're going to put a great deal of architecture behind it. Any hacker who wants to highmark suddenly has this as a target for, I took down the U.S. government's human rights hosting. The third is that I'm not actually convinced that the U.S. government has the best geeks at this stage of the game. And if I were going to make a bet on a set of geeks to be able to keep people up, under sustained attack, I'm much happier to make a bet on Google, Facebook, Yahoo, Akamai, a couple of others than I am necessarily on a poorly funded state department.
There's also just an inherent sort of scaling problem here, which is that Akamai carries something like 2 terabit per second of legitimate traffic. So if the largest attack, you know, that we've seen so far is 100 gigabits per second, or there was one sort of multi-pronged attack that may have been as big as 200 gigabits per second, Akamai is going to notice that, but they can absorb that within their larger traffic. If you're just setting up a service like this from scratch, then you're going to have, the U.S. government is going to have to set up a service that can handle 200 gigabits per second, which is really, really expensive if you're just doing it from scratch. And that's true of any sort of, any idea you have for some sort of startup organization to just take this on and buy bandwidth to do it runs into that issue.
But
But at Vacuum, I wanted to work with state to donate resources. That actually helps us cover some of these things. Then there's just the political questions of intermediary censorship and whether the people that we want to help will, in fact...
And I should say a huge amount of Akamai's business is the government, yeah. By the way. Yes.
Just on that point, the people who are carrying out these attacks, what kind of technical expertise do they have? Obviously, it's a lot easier to run a attack than it is to defend it. But Burma, I'm sure, the Myanmar government doesn't have... like computer academies from which they're training.
It's a highly diversified and commodified market for the various, the malware market in general is highly diversified and commodified. So there are different providers providing separated services at every level from, you can buy someone to infect host for you, you can buy someone to run the botnet, you can buy someone to run a web service that lets you rent it. So it might be just literally there are lots of...
So there are mercenary botnets who would...
Absolutely. Virtually every botnet is...
A mercenary botnet.
Mercenary botnet. So one of the limitations... So it might be useful to think about limitations. One of the limitations of DDoS attacks is they take resources to maintain. So if you just set up like the Great Firewall... Then once you've got that set up and you're filtering traffic at the border, it's pretty cheap to maintain. I mean, there's a maintenance cost, but basically there's very little incremental cost. Whereas a botnet, the main cost of maintaining a large botnet attack is that botnets are very valuable. They can do all sorts of things like steal credit card numbers, they can send spam, they can commit credit, they can commit click fraud, they can do all sorts of things to make money. So whatever part of your botnet you're using to not be sending spam is costing you money. So you have to pay some amount to keep the money up. Virtually every botnet is being used for some combination of those. We have some evidence, not us, but other people have collected sort of circumstantial evidence that the connections of the botnets are it's often not a purely commercial transaction. There's some evidence that, for instance, countries will host these criminal organizations within their boundaries.
Okay,
in,
I guess that's
in,
what I was yeah,
right,
wondering about.
In response to say, you know,
but still...
So if you're a bad country, you can say, yeah, sure, you can host your cyber mafia here, and in return, a couple times a month, we'll ask you to hit some site force. That's right.
One of the things we saw in the WikiLeaks stuff is called like a denial of payment attack, where the payment processors have just stopped taking money. Have you seen that sort of...
So,
on hosting services?
What I would say in general is that experience of denial of payment basically points to the fact that denial of service doesn't necessarily just have to take down a web server. We have a case that we refer to in the report as denial of service by bureaucracy, in which mojcamp.org, major green movement site, has its domain name hijacked. This is because someone intercepts an email, is able to use that email address to change the DNS, and what they basically do is they start a domain name resolution dispute. That dispute lasts long enough to keep that domain name in limbo for 6 weeks until public pressure on Yahoo, mostly from insiders, manages to get Yahoo to come and intervene in the situation. But it was an extremely effective attack. It never took out their web server. What it did was take out ownership of their domain name. If you read the literature, if you go back and read the original RFC on DDoS, it's smart enough to identify that a denial of service doesn't have to necessarily attack IT resources. You can cut the electrical cable to a data center, and that is a denial of service attack. It's a particularly sloppy and obvious denial of service attack, but denial of service basically means you're looking at somewhere in the chain that allows a site to be up. I would say in general, we're not so much seeing payment because most organizations aren't raking in the money that WikiLeaks has been. Usually you see people attack either the web server or the DNS server. And it seems that DNS is increasingly popular. And DNS is really worrisome because it ends up having collateral damage effects. If you just come after me, you end up affecting the other four guys who share my box at Remu Hosting. But if you come after my DNS, you end up affecting hundreds of thousands of people. And I would just say that this is one of those places where I'm not very sympathetic to the DDoS as a form of sit-in argument that's being made, in part because the collateral damage aspect of it is very, very different.
And one of the things that we are seeing is more and more of these DDoSes that are going after systems that are shared like DNS that end up having rather serious collateral damage effects to it. Lewis.
And I think Lewis has to be the last one, then we're all done.
So these botnets out there, is there any way to, I don't know what the term is, but like reverse engineer a botnet? I mean, can one go out and recapture or re...
Well,
yes. So the short answer is lots of people do that. So this Arbor company, they actually have two ways of monitoring DDoS attacks. One is that they just watch for traffic signatures. They have all these boxes sitting around. The other is that they just infiltrate botnets all the time. So if you just get your computer, if you just pretend like you're infected by a botnet, then you can just listen to the command channel. So a lot of their reports of attacks, they're actually just listening to the commands of the botnets. And you also have our friends in Toronto have done a lot of great work in actually infiltrating botnets. So that GhostNet report that I showed you, that was Nart Villeneuve actually and others basically gained access to the administrator console for the botnet. So these botnets are like, I mean, it's you can go online and find screenshots of these very simple, easy to use, like, you know, assign this many machines to attack this site and send this spam. They're even like spam, you know, filter testing mechanisms built in the middle. But so he just gained access to the administrator console and was able to exploit that.
But the larger question that you're pointing to, Lewis, is the only way you solve botnets, and you have to solve botnets to solve DDoS, is by solving security at this layer. And this is one of those interesting places where it would be fun to have Jonathan Zittrain at the table, right? Because the reason these machines are so scary and virus-ridden and filled with backdoors and so on and so forth is because they're generative. They can run anybody's code, including the malware that you bring down onto them. You either need to lock this down on the device level, and by lockdown, I don't mean move into a closed ecosystem. I mean try to figure out how to deal with antiviral and security measures so that you're running clean, or you need to shift that responsibility to the ISPs. What a lot of people in the security community are starting to say is it's really crazy that internet service providers out there know that they have infected computers on their network. You know, a computer that's sending floods of traffic 24/7 is almost certainly an infected computer, and are not taking responsibility for either alerting those users, quarantining those users, somehow fencing those users off. There are ISPs out there like Quest, which basically, once they detect you are infected, will put up a screen essentially saying, we have reason to believe that you're infected. We would love for you to go to one of these places and get disinfected. We're not going to activate your web until you go any further, but you can voluntarily opt out of it. And the reason for the voluntary opt-out is that no ISP wants to lose a customer by saying, you, sir, you are infected, because then your first thing to do is to switch to another ISP. But at some point, we have to start dealing with ISPs as a front line of defense within this. Otherwise, what we end up doing is we go to the ISPs at the end of the process and sort of say, hey, your 150 infected computers have just taken down our website. Do you think you might be able to do something about this?
All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.